tonight. I want to take a moment to say a word or two about why we decided to talk about this subject, because you know there's always a story, right, behind these topics that we choose. This one is not randomly chosen, and if blame belongs somewhere for it, it's me. But I was doing a youth event recently and talking about science in the Bible in one of the sessions. And as part of that, of course, creation evolution is going to be a topic that's addressed in that setting. But when I got done, one of the young men came up to me. It was at the end after the session was over, so things were a bit chaotic. We had to get out of the room we were in, and there was a crowd of people at the end who wanted to talk a little bit, and this guy asked me about theistic evolution. So it's just the worst setting of all to try to give a really good answer to that question. So I tried to give him kind of a short version of my answer about this, and listen, great kid, respectful kid, but he kept asking more. He's like, don't you think we can deal with Genesis by, you know, just saying it's a story about how God created, not necessarily an explanation of the exact way that he did it. And can we be sure the days of creation actually aren't ages of time? And I'm thinking, oh man, there is so much to be talked about here, literally as we're being ushered out of the room. So I was actually surprised to hear him bring up the idea of theistic evolution, because I honestly haven't heard a lot of conversation about that recently.
Okay.
And so I came back and Jeff and I talked about it and did some reading. And evidently, this is a pretty big deal in the broader religious world, and that is the acceptance of theistic evolution.
No, that's right. It's becoming much more acceptable and tolerated and acceptable. So let's put it in that order. Tolerated and then even acceptable in kind of even what are usually we consider more conservative religious groups outside our fellowships, but more conservative religious groups. So in other words, it's gaining market share, we'd say, even among those who otherwise consider themselves believers in inspiration and you know, in the inerrancy of the Bible and things like that. It's absolutely gaining ground in the larger religious world among people that we would consider to have the same views of the Bible that we do.
Right. So I can remember times past dealing with this issue and talking about it in classes and sermons. I don't remember doing that in a while. And so after talking about it, Jeff and I thought it might be good to go back and to have a conversation about this again. I would frame it up this way, and I think this is important. This isn't just sort of a trivial philosophical discussion about different views of the beginning. I think theistic evolution ultimately has some really, really dramatic consequences for the Bible story. And for that reason, needs to be carefully considered. Go ahead.
Well, and just to even elaborate that, you know, it's one of those things where sometimes we think of issues individually, and we don't see how different issues relate to each other. And so this is one of those things where ultimately, and you can actually see this in the larger religious world where groups have already made peace with theistic evolution, other dominoes begin to fall, because whether we realize it or not in the moment, the assumptions about the Bible and how we read it, about the nature of authority and inerrancy, really are tied up in this. And so the mental gymnastics you have to do with certain passages in the Bible, and not just Genesis, there are actually other places in the Bible that sit on this. I mean, we always think of Genesis, we think about creation, evolution. But even more than that, outside, in some New Testament passages, actually, that simply assume special creation by God from the beginning. And so a lot more begins to unravel downstream. Now, that's probably a larger conversation tonight, but just to sit there and say this is not a one-off, we can agree to disagree about this. There are real, fancy words, hermeneutical risks.
Wow, so can you explain that?
Yeah, basically the view of the Bible and how you interpret the Bible that's built into being, you know, finding a way to square the circle of evolution and the Bible together as theistic evolution, a lot of other dominoes, whether we realize it or not at the time, will begin to fall in time, and all you have to do is know where to look in the larger religious world to see this happening.
Right. So Jeff and I have two reasons for wanting to talk about this. First of all, so that we can be together on it. We're especially thinking about our young people and trying to help them gather their thoughts and their thinking on this issue. But the other thing is, we got to talk to people about this. And we don't want any of you, as you're going out having your conversations, trying to talk to people about Christ, kind of being blindsided by the issue. We'd like you to be aware of it and as well give some thought to how to talk to folks about it. So I hope we can do both of those tonight. I didn't know going in, when we first began to sketch this out, how many would be very familiar with what this is. And so I thought maybe just the beginning saying a word or two about what theistic evolution is for the benefit of someone who may not be familiar with this concept. Basically, the idea is that you have two views of the beginning. There is the disciples' view of the beginning, which essentially goes back to Genesis 1 and 2. That's the story, the historical account of how it happened. And then there's the Darwinist view, Charles Darwin, who is on the slide up there. Andrew asked if that was Santa Claus. And
why he's cleaning out his office tomorrow. No, just kidding.
Yeah, so not Santa Claus, Charles Darwin, who is kind of famously connected with this theory, though not the one who originated it. But Darwin's theory, which basically says that life is a grand cosmic accident, that out of nothing came something, and out of the something life sprang, and then over billions of years gradually evolved. That's evolution in a nutshell. There are some varieties to that and some different nuances people make of the theory, but that's basically what it is. And I think to most of us, the whole ideas are mutually exclusive. Either you're going to embrace Genesis or you're going to embrace Darwin, but you can't embrace both,
right?
And so theistic evolution says, well, maybe that isn't true. Maybe there are ways to bring the two theories together so that you could believe both. And so the hybrid is theistic evolution. And I think the reason it's appealing is, on the one hand, it lets us hang on to the Bible and at least some version of our belief in Genesis, but at the same time, it allows us to appear scientifically up to date, since the world has embraced the idea that Darwinism is absolutely proven scientific fact. And if you don't agree with that, I mean, you're just dumb.
Yeah.
And so I don't want anyone to think I'm dumb.
Yeah.
Because I don't believe in Darwinism.
Yeah, and by the way, there's just kind of even making that point, David, there's even a larger point to be made in general, which is when the culture, and it does this in a number of other areas as well, some of them moral, but it keeps on saying, all right-thinking people believe this, all educated people believe this, all sophisticated people believe this, all people who live in the real world believe this. It is very tempting over time to either wear down under the pressure or just want to be part of the people who have a seat at the table as sane, educated, right-thinking, you know, people. And so to try to find ways to have it both ways. And that happens with, you know, and that LGBTQ, I mean, a lot of other things where the culture keeps pushing and pushing and pushing. And across the board, we have to be careful that we don't begin to wilt under the relentless pressure of what the world says, whether it's, again, in the realm of science and evolution, whether it's in the realm of sexual morality and LGBTQ. But this is what sane, educated, sophisticated, right-thinking people believe.
Yeah, which is one of the flaws, I think, in this pressure to embrace this, and that is, if I'm going this direction because I want the world to sign off on me, I'm going to be in trouble, folks, because at the end of the day, it isn't just your view of origins and beginnings that'll get you labeled as dumb. Increasingly, as the gap between where we are and where the world is grows wider and wider, we're going to have to embrace the idea that the world is going to think we're foolish about stuff. So one of the concerns that's behind all of this is a lot of this is about doing something, saying something to make me appear scientifically up to date.
Right.
Which, again, if you want to know how silly that becomes, we've got people in culture today who are saying a man can wake up tomorrow and be a woman.
And saying it's science, ironically.
Yes, and science is signing off on them.
Yeah.
So it's going to get tougher and tougher. And I think what we need to do is embrace the challenge of being looked at like a fool.
Yeah.
Because I think that's the reality of the place we're going to end up in, no matter what.
And so part of what happens too, just to kind of finish the, you know, the renewing of your mind, being transformed by the renewing of your mind piece of this at the 30,000 foot level we're now talking, now where you're just going to have, we're going to have to learn to resist culture, society, education's pressures about what is, you know, assuredly known or something like that. Is this, that more and more we're going to ask ourselves, did I get this idea from reading the Bible, or did I get this idea from the culture, and now I've got to figure out how to make the Bible fit with what I heard in the culture? Whether the culture is claiming the mantle of science, whether the culture is claiming the mantle of this is what justice or morality actually is or involves. You know, a lot of those heavy words, justice, morality, education, science, whatever, these power words that are used to try to force people to compromise to a different authority, because those are authority words in our culture. And so the more and more you have to ask yourself, where am I trying to figure out how the Bible fits with the culture, or am I asking how the culture fits with the Bible? That's got to be a ground zero question across the board that we've got to do. We've got to teach our young people, our children, to do this as well.
Coming back to the idea of the atheistic evolution, it actually in some ways helps the theory of evolution, because as we'll deal with a little bit later, some of the big hurdles for evolution are things like, well, you know, how do you get the startup materials to begin everything? And how do you get life from non-life? If you're going to allow God into the equation, then suddenly you've got some solutions for some of their problems.
Well, yeah, because even just another way to kind of define theistic evolution, it's you know, there are two things going on there. Number one, it allows me to sit there and take, you know, the one of the fundamental assumptions of the theory of evolution, which is, you know, that basically random chance, natural selection, what have you, produce these selective advantages,
right.
And that's how you get, you know, progress in life, you know, in higher life forms and what have you. And so now I actually, now I can keep God by saying God, you know, it may not look like that to the scientists, but really God was behind the random chance, what
right.
appears to be the random chance. And so, yeah, and then the other thing is it solves problems of the Big Bang. You know, where did the stuff come from to start? You know, the Big Bang was when God said, let there be light. And
gotcha.
So now I've got a way to solve, ironically, what science can't ultimately solve.
And then flipping that over, they have some solutions for Genesis too. And y'all may have heard some of these things. One of the things they do with Genesis is they say the days of creation are not 24-hour days, that they're actually ages of time that may have lasted for millions and millions of years, which gives you your time for evolution to work itself out. Or they'll say things like, I think it's more popular today to say, well, Genesis was never meant to be a historical account of what actually happened. It's just symbolism. It's the story God told.
Or even myth.
Parable, whatever.
Yeah.
It's a story God told to say,
I did this.
I made everything.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly right. It's not ever supposed to be understood as a historical account of what actually happened.
Right.
And so they dismiss Genesis by labeling it as a myth or a parable, or, you know, just symbolism, not what actually happened. So the question we have to answer about all this is it true? Because at the end of the day, folks, that's the only thing that matters. And what I mean when I ask, is it true? What does the evidence support? What is logical and reasonable? And so Jeff and I want to explore that a little bit with you tonight, starting with evolution itself and the pressure people feel to somehow make the Bible agree with Darwinism. That seems to me to be kind of the underlying thing behind all of this, is because Darwinism is proven scientific fact, Darwin's evolution, we have to figure out a way to line the Bible up with it, okay? And so one of the ways to deal with this is to first ask the question, well, but is that claim true? Got to be careful about working with someone else's assumptions, and I think that's true in this case as well. The assumption of culture is that Darwin's evolution has been scientifically proven. Yes, but is that claim
true? Well, that's certainly the popular myth about evolution in the culture.
Yes, and I think that's exactly what it is. I think it's a popular myth. And I meant to say this a minute ago. There has been a determined effort to create this myth in our culture. What I mean by that is this. there has been an effort made by those who hold this theory literally to prevent kids, for example, in public schools from being taught anything else. And so we're told you can't have religion in the classroom, therefore the only thing that can be taught is Darwinism. There are a little bit of lawsuits in this country to prevent schools from even mentioning.
Up to the Supreme Court, actually.
Yes, mentioning alternate theories. There was a big lawsuit in Pennsylvania, and I don't remember the school district off the top of my head, but all they wanted was a sticker in the front of their science book that said,
there are other possibilities.
There are other possibilities, and kids are encouraged to explore all with an open mind.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What a terrible suggestion. And the school district was sued and lost because they wanted to encourage kids to do that, which all I'm trying to say by that is the deck has been stacked in favor of one side on all of this, on creating this myth. The other thing that is not being taught in public schools generally is the flaws and weaknesses of the theory. All kids are getting is one side, just the evidence that they believe favors it, and aren't giving an opportunity to have a critical mind to look at the other side.
Yeah, and I think there's two things that are really worth emphasizing here at this point, David. Number one is beware of the word games that even the scientists themselves, as they're claiming authority over this issue, play. You know, think about this. In science, when something's called a theory, why is it called a theory in science? You know, some of you are muttering it, and that's okay. But because it's not actually proven fact, it's still a theory. And so, so what the scientific world does is it takes what it still admits is a theory, but literally the PR campaign is to treat it as fact, which is why no other theories about origins are tolerated.
Can be advanced, yes.
That's exactly right. So notice the word, but scientists know because they can't actually properly, within their own nomenclature, their own way of naming things.
I fixed it. You robbed me of the opportunity.
I fixed it. But this is the dance we do all week.
Nomenclature. Would y'all need help with that one too?
But they literally know they can't change the title of what they're, it's a theory, but they want you to believe it is proven fact. So there's a word game going on right there within the whole thing. The other thing is this, and this is something that's really important to understand. You know, we want to treat it as science, but all stories of origins, all claims about origins, by the very nature, cannot be ultimately adjudicated. Cannot be explained scientifically because origins, by their very nature, are unrepeatable and unobservable. Even if you believe it was goo, you know the goo wasn't taking notes and writing an eyewitness account. And so the problem is, by its very nature, ultimately by science's own rules, these questions cannot be ultimately adjudicated. It's always myth or religion or philosophy that has to sit above science, strictly speaking.
Right. So when the claim is made that this is proven fact, let us suggest to you three topics to consider that I think would illustrate otherwise. One part of this that has not been established as fact, and this gets back to what you were just saying about origins, is the very beginning. Now, I know probably all of y'all have heard somebody at some point talk about it all began with the Big Bang. Assuming that's true, it really still leaves important questions unanswered. If you're going to blow up, you got to have an explosion, you got to have something to blow up, right? Matter. So where did the matter come from? And if you're having an explosion, you got to have energy for the explosion. Where did the energy come from? And you have to have something trigger the explosion, set it off. What caused that? Where did that come from? In fact, you know what? Where did everything come from? And candidly, evolution does not have an answer to that question. All that science does on that issue for them is present problems and challenges. And ultimately, and I mean, you can go to YouTube and look at this yourself. Ultimately, the current scientific theory is, there was nothing, and out of the nothing came something. I mean, literally, you can see eminent scientists like Richard Dawkins, the most famous atheist on the planet. The high school kids know this because we looked at the videos of him in Bible class, claiming that, It was literally nothing. And out of that came something. I think that's a pretty unreasonable answer. Nobody's duplicated that in the laboratory, to my knowledge. The paper hasn't been published on how all that happened, how you get something from nothing. And candidly, it's against everything we know about science. Wouldn't y'all agree with that? And so that's where it all begins, with this idea that you can get something from nothing. They have a beginning problem. Secondly, second hurdle you have to get over is regarding the origin of life. Have y'all heard the evolution story about how life began in the primordial swamp on Earth? I assume that's the goo you were referring to earlier.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that's the non-technical term.
The non-technical term. So you had a swamp with all the right chemicals in it to create the first living thing, right? Of course, the question that begs to get answered there is, where did the chemicals come from? How did they get there? And how did they get there in the right amounts? And that somehow all the chemicals come together and lightning strikes it, and lo and behold, the first self-replicating single-cell animal came alive. You know, that theory was easier to maintain before they discovered DNA. What you got to know, folks, is that DNA has rocked evolution. They're not going to teach that in science class, but it has really made a mess of Darwin's theory of evolution, because DNA is information. And in the simplest one-celled creature, there are millions of bits of data in the DNA that all have to be aligned correctly for this little creature to function as it's supposed to. And if all you've got is nature, that's a problem.
Right.
How do you account for nature organizing the DNA in that first simple creature? Bear in mind, Darwin didn't know anything about DNA when he advanced his theory.
Yeah, he was just looking at, you know, his famous voyage and looking at creatures, you know, out in the Pacific. And, you know, that's a little bit of a stereotypical vision. Yeah. But nonetheless, he was making macro observations. He wasn't looking at how things ticked.
Exactly. And so remember that the guy who's considered the father of the theory had no idea about the mini computer running in the DNA of our cells.
Well, and to take a step back, you know, so what begins to happen as, you know, ironically, we discover more about things as they are. Now, how they came to you, but as they are now, is you mentioned, you know, DNA is functionally information. And so really, again, you're back to information theory now. And is this how we know information and it's theoretical? Now we're doing philosophy. This is the dance you and I do. You know, you like the science arguments, like the philosophical arguments. This is not how information works philosophically. You know, it doesn't, you know, you don't get something out of nothing, and you don't get get this kind of meaning and function randomly and by chance. It takes certain kinds of inputs, intelligent inputs, to develop information in a way that brings meaning. The other thing that's interesting about all this too is causation. Is, you know, there are assumptions about the nature of causation philosophically in all of this that, you know, could be questioned and challenged, because causation itself is a philosophical study, and you can find books on it by philosophers about the nature of causation.
Well, you know, to me, probably the most compelling illustration of the problem this has created is what some of the current theories are about how you get the DNA in the first living things. And you do realize that we have highly regarded scientists in our culture, like Richard Dawkins, like Crick, who is one of the discoverers of DNA.
Yeah, Crick and Watson.
Yeah, who argue that one plausible explanation for DNA and the first living creature is that aliens visited Earth and seeded simple life forms in the primordial swamp. Think about that. And listen, that's just not some, you know, nutty preacher getting up and telling you that. Go on YouTube, not right now, but when you go home, go on YouTube, and you can listen to them say it themselves, that maybe aliens visited and seen life on Earth. So why would they say something like that? Two observations we made about that. Number one, that's the problem. To say that DNA is a completely natural thing, nature did that on itself, is just such an absurd notion that they've got to find something else. Secondly, you'll notice the something else isn't God. Why would they embrace aliens and not God? Because unless an alien's holding a phaser to your head, you don't have to do what he says. But if I make room for God, suddenly I've opened the door to someone who, like as Jeff liked to say, has a right to mess with my life. So the truth is anything but God. But it's a problem for them. It's upended the whole theory. And I think...
Because meaningful information has to come from somewhere.
Yes. Intelligence.
Yeah, intelligence.
Yeah. So number two, they have a serious problem with the origin of life. And the more we understand about life, the bigger that problem gets. This problem is not getting easier and clearer for the evolutionists. It's getting harder and harder and harder with every passing day and every discovery. The third big problem is that you just don't get the evidence for one kind of life gradually evolving into another kind of life. That's the fundamental claim of evolution. And by the way, it's one area where the Bible is in conflict with evolution. The Bible teaches that God created different kinds of animal.
Yeah.
Evolution says that we really started with one thing that ultimately gave rise to...
Yeah, branched out.
You're doing the tree of life. That was a vivid illustration of the tree of
life.
That's
all you're getting tonight.
Yes. But at the base of that tree, at the root, is this one first simple life form. The problem is, there wasn't evidence for that in Darwin's day, but Darwin was convinced that we would get the evidence by doing the science in the years to follow. For example, Darwin was convinced that we would, as we dug into the earth, we would find the fossil evidence for this gradual process of evolution. In fact, if you think about it, if lizards gradually evolved into birds, right? Then you've got to literally have millions and millions of little subtle changes from something that's really a whole lot like lizard to something that's a little more like bird to something that's a lot more lizard than bird and so on. You see the process? Millions and millions of changes over a long, long period of time. And what they anticipated was there'd be all this evidence in the fossils. Well, that just is not proven true. Even if you accept what they claim to have found, which a lot of that is open to argument.
Interpretation, and how do you know you really found a missing link versus a weird animal that was a one-off because, you know, it had a disease or something.
I mean, there's just almost nothing.
Well, and to that end, you know, people always forget that there was a paleontologist named Stephen Jay Gould, Harvard no less, so hardly coming from, mainstream elite institution. And Stephen Jay Gould had the theory of punctuated equilibrium.
Yeah.
Because he was at least honest enough to admit that there were no missing links. The fossil record simply does not sustain the theory. Now, again, to your point, he wasn't ready to go back to God yet, so he came up with a theory called punctuated equilibrium. In other words, you know, rather than standard neo-Darwinian assumptions that it was, you know, slow, gradual changes over the eons.
Happened fast.
You know, yeah, you know, long periods of equilibrium punctuated by periods of rapid change, and they were so rapid in the millions and billions of years of the fossil record, you know, the odds of you finding the transitional forms is virtually none. So basically, he argues even harder, so to speak, without evidence that this must be true.
Well, and the interesting thing about that is that the fundamental theory never goes away. We just come up with a new hypothesis to try to prop up the theory. There are some guys writing about this. So you got all these pillars that have been assumed all this time that have literally just collapsed, and yet somehow the theory is just floating out there without any really basis or support under it. The other problem with this idea that one animal gradually evolved into another kind of animal is, again, DNA. Because what you are as a human being, what your body looks like, your DNA has the info to make that, to make you who you are, to make your body do what your body does. And so one of the problems is, if you're going to become something different than that, well, you got to rewrite code, right? Just like people who work with with software. You got to rewrite the code in the system.
Yeah.
And so their theory is nature rewrote the DNA code, right? But again, the question is,
without bricking the system,
how do you do that, right? I mean, come on. Human beings have been taking dogs and breeding dogs to come up with all kind of new ugly versions of dogs. Yes, that was intentionally a shot at the dog.
Is that because you're a cat person?
No, that is, no. Dogs are bad, cats are worse.
You just don't like God's creatures. This is ironic we're talking about this tonight.
I just don't like caging God's creatures. So, I get in trouble with the dog lovers all the time. But anyway, we come up with all these goofy versions of dogs, but nobody looks at them and says, I think this one's kind of starting to look like a giraffe, right?
Yeah.
You know, they still got four legs and a tail, unless y'all lop it off for some reason, and ears, and it's still fundamentally a dog. It looks like a dog. Why is that? Because there's limits genetically to what we can do. All the crossbreeding you want to, still going to be a dog, and that's because of the DNA. So DNA just continues to be the game changer in all of this, and you know, current evolutionary theory just doesn't have an answer for that.
Well, and along that line, to frame that particular issue a slightly different way. Again, you know, scientists who know that there's a problem with the standard theory. You know, this guy is at Lehigh, Michael Behe is his name. Popular book he wrote was called Darwin's Black Box, but the whole issue there he explored was the concept of irreducible complexity. What he's admitting is that you actually, you know, if the whole, you know, neo-Darwinian theory is you have these random chances that give natural, you know, give an organism a more likely chance to survive, and therefore they're naturally selected for continuation instead of extinction because of these random mutations, these random changes. The problem, he says, is you can't explain things like a highly complex organ like the eye, because Behe's point is, if we're honest, there is no intermediate stage in the eye's development in which it gives natural advantage until you actually have a functioning eye. And so literally the theory can't account for how the eye evolved if they're being honest by the own rules within the scientific system of evolution and its research. And so he blows the whistle and pays the price that all truth tellers within the system tell, which is, you know, kind of being blacklisted and pushed to the side. He was tenured where he was at, so he couldn't be fired. But ignoring the fact that he's saying, look, you know, by our own rules, by our own theories, you can't actually explain how an eye ever gave, short of when it was functioning, how an eye ever gave natural advantage, and therefore an organism, you know, over millions of years slowly developing all these parts that you'd have an eye, ever worked. And I think, I can't remember if it was Behe or somebody else used the analogy of the mousetrap. A mousetrap gives you no...
That was Behe.
Was that Behe? Yeah. You know, the mousetrap gives you no advantage until it works. You know, until then, it's just clutter in the garage. It's just bits and parts and things like that. Until it actually functions as a mousetrap, it does not really give you true advantage in survival.
By the way, it was Darwin who said, if someone could show that there was a part of living things that could not have been evolved over a series of slow changes, something that was irreducibly complex, his theory would be proven false.
Yeah.
So that was Darwin understood. The implication of that. It's just his followers have not. By the way, you heard Jeff allude to Behe not being allowed to teach. And
I can't remember if he wasn't allowed to teach or if he was just kind of
pushed to the side.
Punished in his department.
Yeah. Dean Kenyon was the same way at San Francisco State University, taken out of the classroom. That's how the system is rigged. You see it? So if someone comes along and thinks, it says, I think there's evidence for an intelligent designer. Instead of letting him teach it his way and let the kids weigh the evidence and decide.
Academic freedom.
They literally remove him from the classroom and don't let people hear his voice. Why is that? If all the evidence is in their advantage, I'd love to have the guy teaching the other wacko Bible theory down the hall saying his thing, because nobody will believe it. We'll just give the kids all the other evidence.
Well, and keep in mind, if it's still a theory, then why can't alternative theories be taught,
right,
given that we're all on the search for truth and knowledge here? But the fact that you, one theory and its adherents have to say no other theory and it's their adherence can have a word in a respectable academic space tells you why not. If it's really kind of like Gamaliel said of the Jesus followers in Jerusalem, if it's not of God, it'll die on its own. If we're really truth seekers and this is really in an academically open marketplace, if it's still a theory, and we admit it's the theory of evolution, let other theories be taught and let's see what happens.
I think that we are living in a season where evolution, Darwin's evolution, is being questioned more than it ever has before, which really raises a question for us. Why would we want to try or feel pressure to align the Bible with the theory? I think that's a mistake, particularly in light of all the very, very serious fundamental questions the proponents of the theory are struggling with. Not in a small part, just because, like I said, DNA has just changed everything. Talk about something irreducibly complex.
Yeah. No intermediate stage.
How did you survive without your DNA?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just isn't possible. Okay, we need to deal with the other side of this before we run out of time, and that is the efforts that are made by theistic evolutionists to deal with Genesis. And we want to say a couple of things about that. First of all, if you go back to Genesis 1, there's this suggestion that maybe the days in Genesis are not literally 24-hour days. First of all, a couple of things to say about that. Number one, certainly the word day can be understood in that way. We talk about days that way. We talk about day as being the time of daylight, right? 12 hours or so that we have sunlight outside. We talk about a day as a 24-hour day. We talk about a day as a period of time. We talk about what happened in Abraham Lincoln's day. That's a period of time, not a 24-hour day. And you see the same thing in Scripture. The word day can have a variety of meanings. How do you figure out how it's being used in a certain passage? You know the answer to that. Got to look at it in context. Got to see what's going on in the context. So the question is not, how has the word day used? The question is, how is it used here? And I would just suggest that I think there are some clues. Genesis 1 and verse 5, after God creates light, it says, God called the light day and the darkness he called night. And there was evening and there was morning one day. And so I'm just a believer in the natural reading of the text. I think if the theory of evolution didn't exist, nobody would read this and say, it sounds like ages of time. It just sounds like a normal day. And then you have references to the days of creation in other places. If you go to Exodus 20, for example, do you remember what's going on in Exodus 20? The context? It's the Ten Commandments. And so this is the verse 8, Exodus 20, verse 8, the Sabbath day commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, right? But then he adds, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male or your female servant or cattle or your sojourner who stays with you, okay? So what kind of days are being talked about there? I mean, I assume those are 24-hour days, right? That's what it sounds like. You work for 6 days, you rest on the seventh day. But watch verse 11. He adds, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them and rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the seventh day and made it holy. And so it seems like the days were 7 days. And why not 7 days? Why would that be a problem? If you're not trying to match things up with evolution, which I don't think we need to sweat doing that, then these just sound like 7 days. It strikes me as the natural reading of the text. I don't think that turning the biblical days of Genesis 1 and 2 into ages of time is even really helpful, because you also wind up with all kinds of sequencing problems trying to make the two theories agree with each other. I think it's really, really, even if you grant that, you still have all kinds of problems lining up the sequence. It just doesn't work. The two theories don't match in that regard, in the order in which things came to exist.
And there's, I think there's something else we can do even, David, on the flip side, as long as we're in Genesis 1. And you can play devil's advocate here, actually, you know, where you say, okay, let me play the game on the theistic evolutionist side of the aisle for a minute, and let's just go back and look at the text, and you're telling me, you know, it's metaphorical or it's symbolic or, you know, or what have you. And so this was not, you know, this was not how, to tell me how literally it happened. This was meant to tell me just that God did it, okay? But the problem is, even if that were true, devil's advocate moment, even if that were true, then why would God give me a mythical explanation, even, that seems to imply that there was always differentiation every step of the way? You know, if you're going to tell me a myth, the myth has still got to, even when things are mythical or legendary, they've still got to have some correlation with reality. Otherwise, you know, nobody actually holds to them. No, people don't find, this is now that we're doing anthropology, myths and legends are only held on to in a culture if people find them correlating some way with reality. And so why would God give me a myth or a legend that says things like in chapter 1, verse 11, you know, if evolution was actually true and God knew this, but he's going to give me a myth that just says I did this. Why give me a myth that says, let the earth sprout vegetation, that's life. You know, forget the animal kind of life that we used to think about evolution, you know, apes becoming humans. You got plants. Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, fruit trees bearing fruit, in which is their seed according to its kind on the earth. So now we're not talking about evolution. We're talking about immediate reproduction according to kinds in the plant world. That's not, you know, why would God, even if God's trying to tell me a myth or a legend, just as I did this, why tell me a myth that has not, that is that far, the literal opposite of what actually happened if evolution is the literal truth? Does that make sense?
Which, by the way, so you're not going to satisfy the critic, because that's exactly what the critic will say.
Yeah.
If you came along and said, well, it's just a story, it's just a myth, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it still doesn't work.
Yeah,
it's still in how they would claim things really did happen.
But and that's why, you know, going back to us where we sit, you know, the foolishness of compromising with the world on things is that at the end of the day, if you're compromising with the worldly views on this, you're going to have to compromise what the text literally says at some point. Whether you realize it or not, at the time you begin to play this dangerous game, you're going to wind up at some point along the line compromising what the text actually does say. Even if I want to say, okay, I'll play it on your grounds, myth and legend, why tell me a myth that says this if you're God and the Bible is still inspired?
Right.
Now, if it's a human construct, sure, they didn't know better, whatever. But if it's from God, the myth still has to square with actual reality at some point. And God, if it really is theistic evolution, God knew he was evolving stuff. Why tell me a myth that doesn't work in 2025?
Right. Well, let's talk about this idea. This is, to me, the most dangerous claim of theistic evolution, that the story is just symbolic, mm-hmm. that it's not meant to be literally understood. And to be sure, the Bible uses figurative language. It uses symbolism. In fact, what's the first book of the Bible that comes to your mind when you think about symbolism? Yeah, the book of Revelation, right? So turn back to Revelation for a minute, and let me ask you a question. How do we know the Bible is using symbolism and figures? Revelation. Because the Holy Spirit tells us he is using symbolism. In fact, at one place in the book, he's cried overt about that. There's a vision of Jesus in chapter 1. And as part of the vision, Jesus is standing in the middle of seven lampstands, right? And so if you go down to chapter 1 and verse 20, when the vision is over, this is what verse 20 says. As for the mystery of the seven stars which you saw in my right hand and the seven golden lampstands, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. What is he saying? In that vision, when you saw lampstands, those symbolized my churches. And so it's actually a picture of Jesus standing in the middle of the churches. How do we know that symbolism? Because he tells us that it is. We know that's what he's doing in this book. You don't just get to randomly go to a place in the Bible and say, hey, I think I'm going to decide this is symbolic and not literal. There has to be a reason for drawing that conclusion. Revelation gives us a reason for doing that. So going back to Genesis, what reason do we have to conclude that Genesis isn't literally true? What reason do we have to conclude that he's using symbolic language? Or is it describing events that are beyond God's ability? Is God not able to say, let the air swarm with birds, fill the oceans with sea life? Is God not able to do that? Obviously, he can. In fact, other places, like in Matthew 19 of the New Testament, we have references back to God's creative work in the book of Genesis. Now, the reason that is so serious is if we start randomly allowing ourselves to alter the story by saying, well, it's just using symbolism, where does that stop, folks? Why couldn't somebody go to Acts 2 and say, well, you know, baptism was just a symbol. It's not that we literally need to be dipped in water. It's just symbolic of the cleansing God has done through Jesus.
And this is where, you know, what we said at the beginning, that hermeneutical implications, you know, this is a hermeneutical implication. You know, how you read the Bible in one place is going to affect how you read the Bible downstream in other places. That's why this is very dangerous. And you think you may be able to keep theistic evolution without having other interpretive consequences of the Bible, and you can't. And for my part, here's the last little piece I would add to what we're saying tonight. If you have your Bible, I want you to see something. Romans chapter 5 real quick. One of the other questions, you mentioned Jesus, David. One of the other questions is, how did the apostles read these stories? And in Romans chapter 5, it's interesting because Paul makes direct reference to Genesis. Romans chapter 5, and pick up in verse 12. And for sake of time, we'll read all the way from 12 to 21. And listen, usually we get a little turned on in this passage because Calvinism has made a big mess of this passage, nature of, you know, inherited depravity, you know, original sin, you know, imputed righteousness of Christ. A lot of, but set all that aside, just think about, at the end of the day, what's Paul assuming when he says here, therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sin, and he goes on to explain all that, then, you know, basically through the one act of righteousness of Jesus, life came into effect. If Jesus is literal, right? Jesus is not a metaphor, not a legend, not a myth, not a symbol. Jesus is literal, yes? What's Paul's comparison? A literal Adam. Adam, an actual man, directly created, not a metaphor for the, you know, evolving consciousness of the human race over the eons. An Adam sinned once upon a time, and one man brought sin and death in the world, and so one man at the cross undid what the first Adam had done. Paul reads that story as literally true.
Yeah, where does the symbolism stop? Because listen, folks, fundamentally the problem with the theory of evolution is with evolution you cannot have a first man. You can't have an Adam and Eve. And if you take Adam and Eve out of the Bible story, what have you just done? You've destroyed the whole story of how the problem begins that the Bible is designed to deal with. Genesis 3 is the story of sin entering the world. And there's the promise, the very hazy promise, that one is coming that's going to crush the head of the serpent. It's pointing to the coming of Jesus, our rescuer. Evolution doesn't allow for that story to be true.
Yeah. Which homo whatever in the evolutionary chain is the first Adam? You know, when and how do you know that? You can't account for that. Which individual in the millions and billions of years of evolution is the Adam that Paul's talking about, that Genesis is talking about? And that's why it's so dangerous to play the theistic evolution game. Paul reads the story as there was a guy in a garden once upon a time, exactly, literally what Genesis said happened. And that's where Jesus is answering it, literally as another one man.
So you literally, with this theory, take away the foundation of the whole Bible story. You see the problem? You see the consequences? That's why we said at the beginning of this, isn't it a trivial matter? Isn't this just kind of this political, philosophical discussion about origins and how everything started? At the end of the day, if evolution is true, the Bible isn't. The two cannot go together. But hey, it's a theory with lots and lots of trouble. So the pressure we've been feeling to match up the Bible with it is an unnecessary pressure. We shouldn't feel that way. You guys got some questions about that? We'll be glad to talk about it some more. Let's have a quick prayer before we wrap up tonight. It's been a blessing to be together with your people tonight, Father, and to think about your record of how things began. We pray that you would give us strong hearts and strong faith to face a world that more and more doubts your presence and your work. In Jesus' name, amen.